Is your team not performing well? Is morale low and turnover high? Are you falling further behind the competition? I'm here to help. I'm Shani Magoski, and this is the Leadershifter Show, where business strategy and culture finally meet. Explore shifts of all kinds required to build cultures of trust, engagement, and execution excellence. I promise I am not your typical boring leadership consultant, and I will help you and your team get your shift together.
Hello, Leadershifters, and welcome to another edition of the Leadershifter Show with Shani. I am so happy to be here with one of my most fascinating guests ever. His name is Richard Newman, and he's joining us from just outside of London in the United Kingdom. So say a quick hello, and then I have some other glowing things to say by way of introduction.
Hi, Shani, and hello to everyone listening.
Okay, so Richard is the president, the founder and CEO of Body Talk, which is a communication training firm. And what's, you might say, well, okay, here's what's super impressive about that. Richard was a high functioning autistic, and I'm assuming once diagnosed, always diagnosed, but you've overcome whatever challenges existed for you to then become a communications expert and global trainer. So that's one of the first things I think is super impressive about Richard. He's also done a lot of other very interesting and diverse things. He's an author of a book, all of that is related to communication. He has worked with Formula One. He's gone to India and studied with monks. And I just can't wait for him to share all of his experiences and knowledge with us. So Richard, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you for having me here and looking forward to getting into this with you.
Okay, so take us back to the age and time in your life during which you were diagnosed with the high functioning autism and what that meant for you at the time.
Yeah, great question. So this is something that if people are diagnosed autistic on the autistic spectrum, it's something that they have always had since childhood. And the diagnosis tends to involve looking at childhood behaviors and how you reacted to certain situations and coping mechanisms that came up. I didn't actually get my diagnosis until a few months ago. So I'm 44 at the moment, but I can then look back over decades of my life to suddenly see situations and events that had happened, the way I'd interacted with people and built relationships, and suddenly all of it made sense. It's a little bit like when people watch the second Star Wars movie, they find out that Darth Vader is actually Luke Skywalker's father, and your head goes back through everything that's happened through that story to think, oh, now I understand. And so that's very much what it was like for me, because, you know, when I reflected back over 40 years that I could remember, going back to the age of just 4 years old, I was, you know, relatively happy, had plenty of friends, was enjoying school. And then my parents moved house and I went to start this new school, and I was looking forward to it. I remember getting into this new classroom, feeling excited. And then through the course of that day, started to realize, okay, there's something different about me. I'm not sure what it is. I tried to interact with the children around me, and it was almost like I was in a glass bubble and unable to connect with them. I could see them connecting with each other. I was trying to do what they were doing, but it wasn't working. And so since then, throughout my life, for many years, I've been, if you like, on the outside, looking in on communication, trying to work this out. And the way I liken it to help people understand is it's a bit like watching someone who's hosting a nature documentary, watching, you know, for example, we have in the UK, David Attenborough, who's one of our favorite presenters. He'll say, here we are with this species and we're observing their interactions to understand what it means. And that was very much what it was like for me, looking at neurotypical humans, which is most people, just trying to figure out why is it they're doing stuff? And when I do it, what seems to be similar behavior, it doesn't work. So as an example, banter. Banter was something that really confused me for so many years. What I would see as someone who is high functioning autistic, I would see two people insult each other and then laugh in each other's faces. And that made their relationship better rather than worse. And then, as you can imagine, when I tried it, that didn't work very well. And so it was many, many years.
Yeah, let me go around insulting people and see if they laugh.
Yeah, exactly. So I tried it a couple of times, thought that's clearly not for me. I am just going to be very straight with people, aim to be polite and respectful and not aim to do that part of communication. That's not working. But then I managed to start to investigate communication through reading books, through looking at research. And I read over 200 books on the subject of communication, interpersonal skills, presentation skills, storytelling skills, anything that would help me there so that I could get to the place of improving my communication. But then I got the opportunity to start to teach other people and realized actually looking from the outside at a situation was a huge advantage, because a client can now come to me now that, you know, we've worked with 100,000 people at our company. A client will come to me saying, help me with my presentation skills. It's not working. And because they are, you know, within the situation being neurotypical, they're not quite sure what's going wrong. A bit like, you know, a fish being in water, they can't really see what's going on in the goldfish bowl.
That's right.
When you're on the outside, you can very clearly see, okay, this and this isn't working. And so that's how we've approached this, by devising strategies that have now been scientifically proven. We've created research projects on this to find out what is it exactly that people can do, no matter who they are, no matter how good they feel they are at communication, what can they do to get better results every single time? And we know it works internationally for people of all ages, all genders. And that came from, you know, turning that challenge, if you like, into an advantage.
Great. Well, I do want to come back to those techniques in more detail a little bit later, but first, a little more of your interesting story. Although taking a pause on the high functioning autism for a minute, it's been actually in the news of late, not just in kids and just as in general science. When Elon Musk came out on Saturday Night Live and for the first time in public when he was hosting, he said something like, you know, I'm going to try to be funny for a high functioning autistic, or I don't know, something like that. And so I think it's more and more relatable. And because when we were kids, it wasn't really even a thing to diagnose, there are people just like you who are getting a better understanding of what might have confused them earlier in life now. So
yeah, I think it's something that is becoming more accepted by people and something not to be afraid of. But also the other piece that's important to note is back in, say, the 1980s, the people who were included with an autism diagnosis was very specific. It was people who had a much more severe version, if you like, of autism.
Right.
And since then, it was in the early 2000s, I forget the exact year, where they decided to expand the scope and create this more broad autistic spectrum. And so now there are people who, you know, if you're listening to this, there could be people in your life who are high functioning autistic. And to clarify that, high functioning means that you have an IQ above 70 and the function of speech, because some people are nonverbal autistic with lower IQ. So it's just a simple way to understand that piece. But there could be people in your life who have it, who don't know it, because when we think of someone who's autistic, we may picture something quite different to myself or other people who you may be aware of with this situation. So, you know, for me, I had no idea about this. Many people around me, you know, family, friends, people I work with had no idea about this. When I got the diagnosis, it did suddenly make sense. And, you know, it is something that I hope, you know, people are building greater awareness and greater compassion about. It's why I decided that I would announce to people that I had this diagnosis. And, you know, just to reflect on why that's important, my eldest son is high functioning autistic. And just recently at his school, they were talking about autism, explaining what it is. And immediately at break time, the children, many of the children in the break, were making fun of people with autism, you know, making a sort of silly faces, silly noises, movements, and so on, that for them was what autism was. And he very bravely confronted one of them and said, actually, I'm high functioning autistic. And suddenly they got to learn what that really is and have a little bit of compassion. So, you know, hopefully my sharing this and people getting more awareness of it will build that compassion around this.
Absolutely. In schools and in the workplace, in terms of being colleagues and managing when there are folks on the team. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So before we get into Body Talk, which I know you founded, what, more than 20 years ago?
Yeah, 22 years now.
22 years. Congratulations. That's awesome. Let's talk a little bit again, because I have a fascination with the fascinating, about what you did earlier in your life and your career before founding Body Talk, the things I alluded to in the introduction.
Sure. So what happened was that when I was about to leave school, I had, you know, multiple places offered to me in different universities, but I knew that that wasn't the path I wanted to go on. I had just started to study and get excited about the subject of communication, but also I knew I'd had a relatively privileged life. You know, I'd always had a roof over my head, a relatively large house and plenty of food and good education. And I wanted to go and do something useful for the world. And so I found this opportunity to go and live in a Tibetan monastery up in the foothills of the Himalayas, in a little place called Kalimpong, which is up near Darjeeling, where the tea comes from, in northeast India. And what made this particularly special is that when I got there, they'd never had a teacher before. So, you know, some people go and do teaching overseas, but this monastery, they'd never had a teacher. And so when I arrived,
they never had an English speaking teacher or a teacher.
No, they'd never had any teacher of any kind.
So,
you know, they didn't have a classroom. They didn't have a blackboard. They had, you know, no facilities really. So I arrive at this monastery and I get greeted by these monks who don't speak English. And I thought I was there to improve their English, but it turns out they didn't speak any English. And I was suddenly thinking, well, how are we going to communicate then? How am I going to figure out where I sleep and what time we're going to have a lesson or anything like that? And I sat with them and had aimed to have a conversation, and we really struggled. And suddenly we realized, actually, through body language and tone of voice, there were certain things we could start to understand. And so we got to a place where communication was starting to flow. And I would then host these lessons for them every evening. They'd go out and do prayers around the town during the day. They'd come back. And then normally they'd come back when the electricity would go out. We'd have blackouts most evenings. We're then sitting there with candlelight in their kitchen. And we got a few planks of wood that were then banged together, nailed together and painted black. And I managed to have some chalk with me, and we'd start these lessons. And by the end of 6 months of living with them, they then got to this position of having a decent conversation with me in English. And I learned how to speak Nepali back to them, which was the main language of the area. And I came back just fascinated by this, thinking, you know, most people, I believe, tend to think that body language is about, you know, folding your arms or scratching your nose. And they'll say, oh, you scratched your nose, that means you're lying. I've seen it on a TV show. And it really gets misunderstood. It gets seen as this sort of surface level, superficial element. But actually the way I see it is reverse. Nonverbal communication is something that is universal. Mm-hmm. It is a deeper and a richer way of connecting with other human beings. And so you can think of rapport as being nonverbally traveling together. So we know when we get that sense of being on the same frequency as somebody, having that same vibe as somebody else, there's a nonverbal connection that's happening there, which I've been fascinated with ever since.
I love that for so many reasons. Just a couple of random thoughts. When I work with executive coaching clients and teams on improving their presence and communication skills, I always show them that pie chart that breaks down by percentage what's verbal, visual, and verbal, visual, what's the third V? I'm totally
tone,
blanking
tone
on.
Tone of voice.
What's that?
Tone of voice.
Right, but there's verbal, visual, and I'm blanking. Anyway, what you say is only 7% of how you're perceived on a communication, and people are blown away by that. And of course, I have to explain, no, it's how you're saying it, both the tone of your voice and your intonations and whether you're pausing or not, and whether you're speaking with confidence or tentatively. And of course, your body language, are your shoulders back? Are you making good eye contact? contact to truly connect with people. That is what makes an impression on people, not the words that you say. So I completely appreciate what you're saying about the nonverbal being super powerful in creating rapport and enough connection to communicate.
And something that I've learned through, you know, being high functioning autistic, but certainly that I see everybody doing, doesn't matter if you're neurotypical or autistic or anything else, is that people can go into a meeting and say all of the right words, but end up delivering the wrong message based on what they're doing non-verbally, just not matching the message, and people feeling uncomfortable or confused. You can go in saying that you're absolutely certain that we're going to hit the numbers this quarter. But if you are feeling afraid, if you're feeling a lack of confidence, if you are stressed that week, then what people see is this person doesn't believe it.
She's
stressed. He's uncomfortable. What's wrong with the company? Am I going to lose my job? And you think, I just told you we're definitely going to hit the numbers. Where does that come from? But they're picking up something on the nonverbal level, and they may be misreading stress or distraction as actually you being uncomfortable with your message. So we've always got to think about this. When you go to communicate, this is a key point we always teach our clients. You've always got to have your key focus on how do I want these people to feel by the time we leave this meeting? And everything you do, non-verbally and verbally, through your slides, through the way you answer questions, all of it needs to target that particular feeling. So if the feeling is certainty, you need to look and sound certain. If the feeling is reassurance, then that will change the tone of voice and the way that you present a message. If the position is inspiring, well, of course, that's going to change the delivery. You can't just say the numbers are good and expect people to feel inspired. That has to come through your approach, your delivery.
Absolutely. I mean, and if you give conflicting messages through what you say and your vocal and visual, that's the other V, verbal, vocal, visual, then of course they're going to be confused and they're going to default to believing not what you said.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I do this test with people sometimes. So for those of you watching the video of the podcast, you'll be able to see the visual on this. But I put my hands up and I say to an audience, I can do it with 1,000 people sometimes. And I'll say to everybody, okay, I'd like you all to touch your shoulder. Now, if you're watching the video, you see visually I've touched my elbow. But what I get the whole audience doing is they go, okay, they touch their elbow. Then they're like, wait, what did he say? The shoulder? And then they move it across. And so if we get two messages, one of which is verbal, one of which is visual, they go in different directions. We respond to and believe the visual, not the verbal. And that's why it's so important to have congruency in your communication.
Yes, that's a great word for it. Sounds like also a great party trick.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's fun thing to do with kids, but I found the same thing works with adults.
For sure. Okay. And just tell us a little bit about your time with McLaren Formula One.
Yeah, so I got this great opportunity quite early on where, you know, people may remember that back in 1998, 1999, McLaren were the world champions with Mika Hakkinen driving for them. And then in the early 2000s, the Ferrari team with Michael Schumacher was just dominating Formula One, winning virtually every race. And so we got the opportunity as a team at Body Talk to go in and work with McLaren to then be hosting meetings for them, where we were learning a really critical scientific script. It was very technical, very dry information, but they were putting together, you know, the statistics and interesting facts about the team and how they built the cars and the engineering processes involved. And we then learned this script, which was 2 hours long, 20 pages of technical information. And then between us, we then delivered that same script 1,000 times for people who are coming in from all over the world. Sometimes we were working with 3 different interpreters at once for 3 different countries worth of people. And during the course of delivering that, this was a phenomenal opportunity. Just imagine the possibilities you have. If you deliver the same message 1,000 times to 1,000 different groups of people. And I thought, this is extraordinary. Like for me, I didn't know I was high functioning autistic, but I knew that, you know, I wanted to improve my communication. So every single day I thought, this is like Groundhog Day. I can go in and deliver this same message in this same space, and I can just make a small change and see if this makes the delivery better. See if I get better engagement. from people or not. And if it doesn't, I delete it and I move on to something else. And so I was doing that day in, day out for 5 years that we worked with them on this project, to the point where I thought, okay, I've got a set of techniques here I know works with every audience from every different industry and background that I'm dealing with day to day. I can now start really teaching this stuff with great confidence. And so we then started teaching that, building up the techniques even further, to the point where I thought, I know this works, but I really want some better science behind this. And so that was when we then engaged with UCL, University College of London, in a study that involved more than 2,000 people from all over the world, men and women aged 18 to 65. And we created this series of videos. And in the video, the person speaking to them would wear the same clothes and say the same words, but in each of the videos that we created, they would be slightly changing their nonverbal behavior to see if that changed the reaction they got from people. Okay. Now, the people watching this, they would only watch one video, and then afterwards they would rate the person on how confident are they, how convincing are they a good leader, do I believe in them, would I vote for them in an election? And also what they didn't realize was that we had 100 variations of the video. So we had some were men presenting, some were women, some were older, younger, lighter skin, darker skin. And we tested this in places from sort of Mumbai to California. Wow. And what we found is it didn't matter. In the video, it didn't matter if the person was a man or a woman, didn't change the ratings, which surprised us. It didn't matter how old the person was who was watching it. It didn't matter what the person's skin color was. These things were not changing the ratings, which again surprised us. But what we did find is that if you go from the most common habits people have day after day at work, and you shift those across, just subtle shifts, to what we found was the most effective style, you can increase how good a leader people think you are by 44%.
Wow.
You're wearing the same clothes, you're saying the same words, and you change a couple of behaviors, and suddenly you get that result. And that for us was a massive result. We didn't expect anything like that. But the thing I enjoyed most about this is that we realized it wasn't about teaching people manipulation techniques to try and get those results. It was actually about getting people to come back to how they were born to speak, getting rid of habits that so many people have that are getting in the way. And when you come back to that more natural version of communication, it lights people up. It energizes them. It makes them want to support you and believe in your message. So we were really thrilled with the results.
I love that you did the research after you had essentially a learning lab in doing 1,000 of those for McLaren. And so you got the qualitative data, and then you got to prove it with the quantitative study. That I'm surprised too that it was more about some of the mannerisms and almost imperceptible behaviors versus some of the exterior things that people tend to judge. So are you willing to share what some of those small behavior changes are that both your qualitative and quantitative research confirmed for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, a really common phrase I hear clients from all over the world say is that often they say, look, I've been told by my boss or I've been told by my clients that I gesture too much, so I don't want to use my hands. Or I get other people saying to me, I just don't know how to use my hands when I'm in an important meeting, an interview, doing a presentation. What should I do with them? You also finally get some people who find one gesture that they feel quite happy with, and then they end up doing that same gesture over and over again, feeling like, yeah, this is great, I'm being really energized and dynamic. And the whole audience is thinking, could you just stop moving your hand, because it's too repetitive.
And so what we found,
really visually distracting. And so what we found is, firstly, if you do no gestures, you get terrible ratings. You're not confident, you're not convincing, you wouldn't win an election, you're not a good leader. And that's whether you sort of hold them in a middle position in front of you or put them down by your side. Either way, you get terrible ratings. Secondly, if you do low gestures, so these are gestures that are below your waist. If you're wearing a belt, they're below the belt. And you do them with low energy, which is what some people do. If they're feeling a bit nervous, they do these low, limp gestures. Again, you get terrible ratings. The best ratings, in contrast, that we found is if you do a combination of a palms up gesture that needs to be slightly away from the body, not against the body, because you look like you're sort of squeezing yourself or you look afraid, slightly away from the body and between shoulder and waist height. So by doing so, you look open, you look confident, you look proud of your message. And then you can do the same gesture with palms down. Now, the difference between palms up and palms down, again, is universal. You can see this in hieroglyphics that are 5,000 years old. And so palms down is for strong closed statements and palms up is for open statements.
Yep.
And if you use a combination, just those two, you don't need to go much further than that. Of course, there's thousands of different types of gestures you could use. Descriptive gestures, all sorts of things. But using palms up, palms down, it means the same thing around the world. Whereas like thumbs up means something different in different countries. Palms up right. and palms down is universal. And suddenly you get this lift going from using no gestures or limp gestures up to using palms up and palms down congruently in your communication. So palms down for strong messages, palms up for open messages, and you get that lift of 44%. But also it needs to include the second key area that was fascinating is that we see this so much, whether someone is at a networking event, maybe just talking to one person or having a conversation in a corridor or maybe doing a presentation or leading a team meeting, you continuously see people standing with their weight on one side. So leaning on one hip, or maybe sometimes casually with what like one foot with a toe off the floor. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they'll either stay there or they shift back and forth. Either way, you look like a pushover in this position. So just imagine whenever you're standing and speaking to people, if someone was to place one hand on your shoulder and push you, would you fall down? If so, you look like a pushover. So imagine that when you're speaking to a team and you're saying to them, you know, hey, everybody, we need to get this finished by Friday at 2 o'clock. If you're standing where you're leaning to one side, you have low limp gestures. They'll think, this person's a pushover. I'll do it on Monday. I'm busy. I'm leaving early. Whereas if you allow gravity to work with you, so you're standing in a position where you are centered, gravity going straight down in your body. If someone was to push you, they would have to work much, much harder to move you because gravity is now working with you, not against you. And so you physically, visibly have gravitas. And if you speak from that position, people associate gravity and that extra strength and power to your message, they're much more likely to do it.
What I so appreciate about that is you distill it down to three easy steps. Be who you are and don't pretend to be someone else. Pay attention to those hands up, hands down gestures and stand confidently on two feet as opposed to being a pushover, which by the way, that is phenomenal that it's literally and figuratively a pushover when you're leaning to one side or another versus the litany of things that you would learn in a typical class or in Toastmasters to master your presentation and present skills. And with a list that long, you can't possibly focus on everything. So I always appreciate a framework that is sort of like a 1, 2, 3. And I also want to pause and challenge any of you leadershifters watching or listening to observe yourself and ask others to notice and give you feedback, especially on the hand gestures and the posture of not being a pushover. Start to recognize, film yourself in a meeting. You don't even have to let people know because you're not filming them. Just kind of put your iPhone in the corner and then you can view yourself later because you'll never know what you're doing or what you're not doing or what you can improve unless you see it for yourself. It's a super powerful tool. And I don't care if it's awkward, you're the only person who's gonna see it. You have to recognize what your blind spots are in any place that you're trying to improve, including this arena. And you've got just a couple of obvious things to look at, which will make a big impact if you can adhere to them. So, okay.
Yeah, I think that's great. That's really good advice. I particularly encourage people to record themselves if they can. Sometimes I hear the advice of, you know, practice in front of a mirror, and it depends on how you feel about that. It can make people feel very self-conscious doing that sort of thing. So instead, if you record it and then watch it back, you're going to get a much much better response from it and be able to learn from it as you move forward. So yeah, great way to do things. And if people really want to sort of keep it in mind in future what they're supposed to do, I often talk to people about tennis. So I'm always keen to give people a strategy they can definitely use, they can definitely remember. So if you imagine that you're about to play a game of tennis and somebody else is going to serve the ball to you, what do you do? Well, you get grounded in your posture, and you're not going to lean on one hip as you're receiving the ball. You're going to get grounded.
That's right.
Going to use forehand and backhand. So just like palms up and palms down, you've got those few things that you need to use. And importantly too, when people play the game of tennis, there's rules that you need to use in playing the game, but every person plays it differently. So you're still allowed to bring in your personality, your way of doing things while, you know, using these pieces that we know work for everyone.
Right. There's a book, I'm sure you're familiar with it, called The Inner Game of Tennis. You're now talking about the outward game of proverbial tennis.
Yeah, exactly right.
I like that set of books.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed that book. That was a great one for me because I've always looked at communication from the outside in because I thought, okay, I can observe something. And if I change it, I'm getting different results. And actually it changes my level of confidence. I was never somebody who thought, okay, I know what I'm doing, but I just need the confidence. I very much thought, I don't know what it, like I can be as confident as I want. I still don't actually know what I'm doing. So I've always approached that. And I found that a really effective coaching technique for our clients too, is often they maybe get stuck in their mindset about how they should communicate. And if you start on the outside, you know, the inside affects the outside affects the inside. So if you change your actions, it will change your results and therefore change your personal beliefs in your ability to speak and engage people in a meeting.
Absolutely. Okay. So the other thing I wanted to ask you about is, I don't know if this goes along with being high functioning autistic or if it's separate and unrelated, introverts. Because there's so much talk about, introverts can't lead, introverts can't present. And it's bullshit, of course, because the official definition of introvert and extrovert is you get your energy from being alone, you get your energy from being with people. If you could dispel that misconception, and as an introvert, what's your perspective on that?
Yeah, so first of all, I don't know at this point. I haven't seen any evidence to show if there is an introvert or extrovert link in any way to high functioning autism. I don't believe there is, but I was interested to ask that question myself. But what I can speak of is, you know, having now through our company trained 100,000 people, I've had so many people come on the courses that we run saying, look, the thing is, Richard, I'm never going to be a good communicator because I'm an introvert and I'm shy. And I'll say to them, okay, well, I'm shy. I was always introduced when I was younger. My parents would introduce me by saying, here's our son, Richard. He's very shy. And I was like, is that my middle name? Like, why does this keep on coming up? And so I was always introduced that way and very much was. And I'm absolutely an introvert. Every time I've taken the different studies, personality profiling, different events that I've been to, I end up on that scale because it's a scale between introvert, extrovert. I'm 99% introvert. And so something that I've noticed with our clients is when they say I'm an introvert, I actually get really excited because I've found that they are more quickly going to pick up what I'm teaching. Because they're looking for a way to really express their voice and strategies that they can use that are going to get them there. Whereas somebody who is extrovert can still absolutely be a great communicator. I've tended to find that extroverts can be stronger speaking one-to-one with people. And then when they stand up in front of a group, because there's less of the back and forth communication, that they can sometimes struggle more with that public speaking unless they find a way to create the interaction, to invite the questions, to build a discussion, to be a facilitator, and suddenly then they open up. But either way, if you have any doubts at all, no matter what the excuse may be, where you think, okay, I can't be a good communicator, you absolutely can. And so to give actually an additional point on this, I was interviewing on a podcast going back a few years, maybe 3 years ago, a lady who is a specialist in childhood communication. And she deals with people at sort of preschool level. And she said that based on their research, they said 90% of people are born able to freely communicate, no challenges. 2.5% of people are born with some sort of permanent challenge, like permanent hearing loss, which they'll always need to deal with. And then the other 7.5% are those who are struggling initially, need some support, and can gradually overcome these challenges, but may never find things as easy as the 90%. And this is when it started to dawn on me. I said to her after the interview, I was just driving her back to the railway station. I said, I think I'm in that 7.5%. And she said, no, you can't be. You run a communications company and you teach on stage and you host a podcast. There's no way. And I said, okay, just take me through the assessment of how I would know if I am. And we both realized by the time we got to the station that I was indeed in that 7.5%. And she said, you know, that it just goes to show what you can achieve if you put your mind to it. And for me, you know, for years, I just thought, I am going to get better at this. There's no choice. I absolutely will. And once I've figured out what works, I'm going to share that with other people.
Right. So if anybody and you obviously had a lot of ideas from reading 200 books.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I really wanted to do my research and not just guess, but, you know, doing people watching day to day, as well as reading all the books that I could to figure out how to get better. So, you know, we all have that capacity to become more of what we'd like to be in a different area. And as I often say to people, you know, if you start to learn how to play tennis, it doesn't mean you're necessarily going to be the world's greatest and win Wimbledon, but you can learn how to play the game. Even if, you know, you're standing up with a lack of coordination to begin with. And the same goes with communication, same goes with leadership.
Right. One more really important piece of presenting is storytelling, right? Because yes, people will find you credible if you're making the right movement and you have the right posture. And they still may not remember what you said, even though they found you credible. And many of us know that what makes ideas stick a lot more is if we're contextualizing them with stories and analogies like tennis, etc. So what's your 2 cents on storytelling and how to weave it in that authentic, credible way?
Yeah, so storytelling has been, you know, a buzz term for people, I think really for the last 10 years, certainly the last 5 years, but there's right. Huge misconceptions around this. And I had the privilege of speaking to Robert McKee, who's called the godfather of storytelling in Hollywood. His students have won over 60 Academy Awards, 200 Golden Globes. And so I was asking him about this and he said, you know, you wouldn't listen to a piece of music and assume that you can be a composer. But most people think, oh, I've heard stories, therefore I must be a good storyteller. And actually there's stuff that you need to learn in order to get good at this. Mm-hmm. But importantly with stories, it's not just about getting good at sharing anecdotes or getting good at sharing, you know, your life story or major events. Storytelling is a framework that lets the human brain understand the world. And so you can see this in research going back to where Joseph Campbell was the first person who really popularized this idea and brought it to the forefront, where in 1949, he published his book, A Hero with 1,000 Faces. And he said, look, there are civilizations that never met each other from different parts of history who were telling stories with the same structure. And therefore, this is the way that human beings want to receive information. And so when you're thinking about storytelling, it's really about understanding how does the human mind want to hear something? We don't like going into meetings and seeing lots of spreadsheets and bullet points. It puts us to sleep. And people recently have been talking about having screen fatigue or Zoom meeting fatigue. And then, you know, at the end of the day, they close down their laptop and they go and watch Netflix for 3 hours. So it's not really screen fatigue. What the screen has with Netflix has got stories and most of our meetings don't. So you can turn any meeting, any communication, any email into a storytelling structure such that people understand the big picture journey, the details and the actions. You guide them through this in that storytelling structure. And we did this. We worked on the fact that, you know, Joseph Campbell's version has 17 steps. You can't do that in an email. Christopher Vogler in the 1980s, he came out with 12 steps. We've really boiled it down to just a few pieces you can do every day, which essentially means you connect with people from the survival mind and the emotional mind before you connect with the logical mind. And most people are doing the opposite. They're spending most of their time just aiming to connect with the logical mind. It goes in one ear, out the other ear, and nobody's going to remember because they don't understand why they should care or why it's important for them. And that's what the structure of storytelling does. And you can apply it to, you know, every interaction you're having with people.
Brilliant. Brilliant, as they say in the UK. Brilliant.
That's right. I get caught saying brilliant or terrific quite a lot.
Well, it's better than Americans. We say awesome.
That's right. Whenever I've had an extended stay in the States, I come back and calling everything awesome until I return to my Britishness.
Yes. Well, this has been a really fun conversation. If people want to reach you or hire you, what's the best way?
Well, the best place to find me and my team is at ukbodytalk.com, ukbodytalk.com. There's loads of free resources on there, videos, articles, and you can get in touch. You can find me on LinkedIn. That's my main place on social media. Richard Newman from Body Talk on LinkedIn. And also, if you're on Instagram, it's Richard Newman Speaks.
Great. All right, leadershifters, take those notes down, as well as some of the highlights that I'll just recap from the notes I was scribbling, assuming I can read my own writing. So the first major takeaway for me is don't let any obstacle keep you stuck or let it be an excuse. And of course, the story that Richard shared about reading 200 books and practicing and figuring out a way to make boring technical car information compelling and then learning from it and backing it up with research. Yeah, it might take work. Oh my gosh. It is possible, however, and there's no free lunch. The importance of body language. And I mean, we talk about that as if it's so obvious in people with people who can understand each other, right? But your sharing took it to a whole new level of literally learning to coexist and communicate with people with whom you didn't speak each other's language, and yet were completely reading each other's energy and picking up what the others were putting down, so to speak. And then ultimately those connections allowed you in a relatively primitive way to teach them to be conversational in the span of 6 months, which I think is incredible. Another kind of hero's journey, by the way, if you know we want to talk about storytelling. And then the statistic that you shared, around 44% increase in perception and leadership potential with the small shifts around hands up, hands down, standing with both feet grounded so as not to be a pushover. I think all of those things are extremely valuable. And I'm certainly going to put them into place. And I hope those of you who are with us today will do so as well. Thank you again so much for joining us. This was a true pleasure. Keep in touch.
Many thanks. Thanks for having me.
You bet. And leadershifters, till next time.